This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio and online Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to begin our show with an entertaining discussion about an old story in Minnesota, and a friend and somebody who's somewhat acquainted with the state, Peter Stormer. You probably remember him from his breakthrough role in Fargo, the movie that put Fargo on the map. But lately, he's been working on a project for Discovery Science Channel, Secrets of the Viking Stone, which is the Kensington Runestone. Peter, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, you betcha. It's an honor.
Thank you for that. What attracted you to the Kensington Runestone story?
To make a long story even longer, when we shot Fargo, I was riding around in my car when I had a couple of days off, just visiting old Swedish places. Being in Scandinavia, Minnesota is very important to us. And I ended up in Alexandria, and I saw, well, you know, it was interesting, the runes, and, you know, in school, familiar with runes when I grew up in Sweden. So it was kind of interesting. But it never dawned to walk around really and look, and maybe it wasn't on display 20 years ago when we did Fargo, 25 years ago. But recently, 3 years ago, I was up there scouting for another movie. I came upon the stone again, and I saw the photo of Olav Oman, the guy who found the runestone in 1898, and darn, he looked exactly like me. And then I read under the picture of him that he was from a place called Forsa, which is next door to my birthplace, Arbro, in Hälsingland, Sweden. And I thought, I'll be damned, this guy looks like me and he's from the next village over. And I've been in that village many times as a kid playing soccer or baseball, you know, competing with other schools. And then I read we were born 100 years apart. We immigrated 100 years apart to this lovely country. And I thought, these circles are strange. I can't let go of this. And it just kept pounding in my head. And I said, I have to set out to clear his name, because I discovered he was accused of doing this himself. And his family was ridiculed. They went through a lot of hardship. And none of the academics or scholars that been, you know, like hammering his head with accusations, they are not familiar with what the immigrants went through at the time with the homestead and how poor they were and the conditions they lived under. And it turned out that Olav Oman and his wife and two kids lived in a cave for 18 months during two winters, just trying to build a little shack where they could light a fire, you know, and they were bound to, after 3 years, to have a certain amount of acreage plowed. And then after 5 years, they're supposed to have a house. Otherwise, they have to leave the homestead. So I just wanted to set out to clear his name, his family name, and fight for a fellow from my county. If he had been from another county, I wouldn't have given a rat's ass. But it felt like a brother.
Now, this the story, the series on the Discovery Science Channel is titled Secrets of the Viking Stone. I think at one point it was titled The American Runestone. You reference this. Are there runestone stories closer to where the Vikings originated, like around where you grew up?
Oh yeah, in Sweden there's a lot. I guess it's like 5,000 still, you know, Norway maybe 3,000, and in Denmark they're beautiful. A lot of them are very beautiful, very similar to this guy, which they found up in Minnesota. But the linguistics are a little bit hesitant to say this is a true artifact, because the language is not really correlating to the language which they spoke, you know, in the 10th, 11th, 12th century in Scandinavia. And they know. And I said, how do you know what language was spoken? I mean, all the regions were so, I mean, all the regions in Sweden, it wasn't one kingdom like today. It was made up of 250 different kingdoms, and Norway of 150 different kingdoms, small little huts and villages. But they say this is not the language they spoke. So this is a forgery in the 19th century or 18th century.
How would you describe your approach to telling this story, which has been told before, but not in 12 episodes featuring Peter Stormer?
No, it just started with me setting out with a team and taking my retirement fund and taking money and just setting out to really have people investigating in this stone, to have scientists like physicists, geologists take a closer look at the stone. And I found Scott Walter, a Minnesotan that is very, famous from Unearthed, his TV program on History Channel. And he did some tests on the stone. And actually, they've been testing me on this stone like 10 years after it was found. And the head geologist of the Minnesotan Historical Society said the same thing. And these engravings are weathered like 250 to 300 years. And Scott Walter, on the back of the stone, there's rootlich, as you say up there, rootlich. And they also could, today, the last couple of years, they can see a tree where the roots have sort of an acid when they mature. And it had been buried at least for 25 to 45 years under a tree. So by the time it was under that tree, all of Omar was a little kid, 5 years old, in Forza, Helsingland. So how the hell could he have carved it? And I want to set up a court hearing in the fifth season with all the experts and have all of Omar's spirit there and just to clear his name and clear the family's name that they didn't do this, because they became a laughingstock and all the newspapers around the world and in Sweden wrote about this guy who carved the runestone. But the thing is that all of Omar that found it gave the stone away, never made a cent of it, never had put it on display and charged people for coming and see it. I would highly debate my friend from the next door village. Then I would have suspect some foul play. But he gave it away, didn't want to have anything to do with it. He said it just brought devastation and sadness to my family that I found that stone. According to his grandson, Darwin, who's still alive and thriving, a great guitarist up there in Minnesota, Minneapolis, he said that his grandfather said that, I wish I never had found that stone. And I just want to clear his name. I'm not out there to debate whether Vikings were on U.S. soil or North American soil, which is now proven with up in Newfoundland, that Leif Erikson was there, and now it's a museum. But the two people from Norway who found Lonesome Meadows up in Newfoundland, they were fighting for 15 years to got it declared proven right, because all academics and scholars said from the beginning it's a fraud. It's a hoax. No one was here. But now it's declared, authentic.
Peter Stormer is the host and the principal in the new Discovery Channel Science Channel show, Secrets of the Viking Stone. And Peter, your co-star, I guess, is Elroy Bolgard. Tell us about him.
Elroy Bolgard is a genius and a very funny guy and a amazing illustrator. He is he's very knowledgeable of history, and sometimes he jumps from being very, very correct according to the Bible, and then he has theories about that contradict himself. Him through a YouTube video he had posted, and where he was trying to raise some money to do a documentary about Ashby and some corpses that was found in Ashby that he thought were connected to this story of the Vikings being there. or the Scandinavians, I would say, that was there in the 14th century. So we found him, and I was lucky because Tainer, he's a great musician, he has a band, and he's just talent, more talent than me, to have to put him down occasionally for not taking too much space. He's my co-star. He's not the star.
Fair enough.
but he was born and raised in Minnesota, and it's so nice to have somebody who knows everything about around that area where the stone was found and all the investigations that he has done. That was a great knowledge coming from sort of a regular guy, but with a great knowledge and interest to solve this mystery.
Some of the blurbs about the secrets of the Viking stone, which will air on Discovery Science Channel and will also stream online for those people who want to find it that way, is it? It's the Minnesota Da Vinci Code. It's very Fargo-esque, is one description for it. So describe your approach to telling this story. Obviously, you're not getting too deeply into the debate of whether it's authentic or not. You're talking about the fellow who found the stone and trying to kind of reclaim his place in history. Is this a quirky journey through Minnesota? How would you characterize the approach?
No, the approach is not quirky. I think it has some humor in it, because you've got to have humor when you meet people who has try to prove you wrong. And you have people who says, you're just doing this to make a lot of money, and it had cost me a fortune so far to make this out of my own pocket. It is mainly, from the beginning, just to clear his name. But the deeper we got in, it's like walking into a room. You walk through one door, and you get into a room with 12 other doors. Huh. And you pick a door, and then you open that door, and there's 24 new doors. Every night after we did a shoot during the day, we were faced with some new angles of the whole story, that we met somebody who came up with a completely new theory why the stone was there and how it was found. So we had to open that door and see if it had any truth or value to the story. Some of them had value to the story. So it is like, I would call it like juggling. You have two balls you juggle with, and then somebody throws in a third ball, and you have to juggle that ball too. So it is sort of Olav Åman and his wife Karen and his children, six children. It seems like they are there with us, helping us and guiding us in a here we come to the Da Vinci Code of Kensington, Minnesota. But it is also a spiritual journey for me to take part in people who lived 100 years before me, to understand the situation they lived under, the poverty without not having food on the table, and to understand the hardship of the immigrants, whether it was Scandinavian, if they were German, Spanish, and also it got me to understand the Native Americans. We're working with Matt Northrup, who is a Chippewa, and he is helping us also on this journey, because the Native Americans, for them, according to him, of course they traded with white people from the East, that came to North America and Canada, or to USA and Canada, and traded, were fur traders, even in the year and onwards. And they have a lot of knowledge that we don't know much about. I didn't know much about, and slowly, slowly, they have let me in. And in future episodes, we go into the Native America and about their knowledge about the white man who came to trade furs many, many hundred years ago. So it goes back 1,000 years. You know, it didn't start with Columbus and the French traders. It goes back so many, many hundreds of years.
Peter Stormare is well known to movie buffs as the heavy, one of the heavies, and the most sinister one in the movie Fargo back in 1996. But he's been doing a lot since then. You've done a ton of movies, and now you've got your own production company, Viking Brothers Entertainment, and you're a director on this series, The Secrets of the Viking Stone, which is on Discovery's Science Channel. So how did you pitch this to Discovery?
It was a lot of help through a Nordic entertainment company called Nent and Viaplay that liked the idea very much. And they came up with some money to give us so we could do like a pitch story that they gave us thumbs up. Let's go ahead with this. And this was pro COVID, which made it more simple then. And then also Discovery Channel and some other channels came in and were interested in the story. So that's how we got started with a great, great channel in this country, because it's got to be seen in this country too. And hopefully it's going to be seen in all of the world and cast some light on this continent and how the story has been rewritten. And it's got to be rewritten again.
Well, you've done 12 episodes. Are there plans to do more?
Yeah, we were about to shoot in May, June, and to do a big excavation up there on the Runestone Hill. And we got a permit from the Minnesotan authorities and the archaeologist, the head archaeologist of the state of Minnesota, to go ahead and excavate. Because we have found some really, really interesting material up there and could date back to this expedition or to a Native American settlement that goes back many, many hundred years. So that knoll at the Kensington Runestone Hill, which I urge everybody to go and see him, not now maybe with a ton of snow, but in the spring and summer. It's a beautiful place, and you can actually feel it must have been a great place to hide out and to have a great lookout for all the surroundings. And maybe it had been a Native American settlement from the 13th century up there, or 14th century, which is worth excavating. So in the future, that's we had a green light to go ahead in May, June, but because of the COVID, we couldn't do anything, and hopefully we can do it this year in May, June. And then I'm planning on bringing Elroy and Darwin, Olof Åman's grandson, over to the birthplace of Olof in Sweden, and maybe go over to Scotland and then over to Iceland, Greenland, and end up in Kensington once again. And the fifth episode would be just a big court hearing between all the academics and all the regular people around Kensington, and that has a lot of knowledge, and they have their theory, and just have a verdict from a judge whether Olof Åman was guilty of this so-called runestone, the Viking stone, if he was the perpetrator or not. I want the gavel to rule and hopefully clear his name. That's my whole journey. I want to clear his name because his family went through so much devastation because of this stone he found.
But it sounds like you want to actually recreate the journey, the alleged journey of the Vikings from Scandinavia to Scotland to Iceland to Greenland to Newfoundland and perhaps within the country. To sort of tell the story of that possible migration.
We know so far today, and we talk, and I've been talking to nautical people who's been traveling. They are seafarers, and for generations, the families. And we have one from Norway that has a big tradition and goes back way, way back in history. They've all been, you know, seafarers. And he just said very bluntly one day, he said, I've been sailing, you know, with a ship, similar to Viking ships. I've been sailing from Norway to Iceland, to Greenland, to Newfoundland. And he said, you know how long it took me to go from Norway to Iceland? It took me 4 to 5 days from Iceland to Greenland. It took me 4 to 5 days. And to go over to Newfoundland, it took me 4 to 5 days on that ship. And he said, imagine 1,000 years ago, how long do you think it took? The same time. It was the highway of the earth, was waterways. And they knew the waterways. When they had a current going in the right direction, when they could sail, when they couldn't sail. So he said, they got to Newfoundland in 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks the most.
The late Robert Asp, who created a replica Viking ship he dubbed the Hjemkomst, and which he passed away before it could actually demonstrate his theory that the Viking ship could very easily have crossed the Atlantic, and he did. His descendants were on that ship, the Hjemkomst, that sailed from the harbor in Duluth on the St. Lawrence Seaway across the Atlantic Ocean to Bergen, Norway. So that demonstrated, I know you visited that replica ship because it's in the Hjemkomst Center in Moorhead.
Yeah, it's a beauty. And I think way before the Vikings, there are tons of books that are plowed through. I mean, people were sailing over to the South Americas and the North Americas way before the Vikings, too. Way before the Vikings.
Thor Heyerdahl, another explorer, adventurer, demonstrated the Polynesian route in the South Pacific.
Yeah. And he was debated for, he's still debated, saying it's a hoax. Until, 10, 12 years ago, they found DNA that proved him right. You know, that it's, and that the Asians were sailing over to Peru and Chile. And in Chile and Peru, there's a lot of Japanese and Chinese DNA. So how do you think that happened?
Well, a former president of Peru was Japanese Peruvian.
Yeah. It's just, for me, it is so, it's so plausible. Is it possible? First you say, is it possible? Yeah, but is it plausible? And usually you get a no on the plausible, but here I always get a yes. Could people from China and Japan sail over to the country over, at the East Coast to the East, which was the Americas 5,000 years ago? Yeah. And Thor Heyerdahl proved them right. But unfortunately, in academia, it's very hard to fight their opinion because they jeopardize their situation and their salaries too.
Okay.
And but many of them are very knowledgeable, but some scholars and academics, they are very reluctant to say this stone in Kensington, and this I've heard, and they want to be off record. They say, of course, with all the tests that's been done, he didn't do it. But I don't believe there were descendants of the Vikings coming down there in 1362. Well, I don't believe that the Templars were there or the Freemasons. But I believe the geologists and the physicists saying that it's been there for at least 250, 300 years ago. And if you go back from 1898, 300 years ago, who put it there in 1598 then? And scribbled down those words, which must have taken them quite some time to do that stone. And why did they write 1362? Is it a code, perhaps?
Well, that's one of the secrets of the Viking stone, which will be peeled away like an onion by Peter Stormer and his associates. Again, this is being carried by Discovery's Science Channel. You'll have to look for your cable listings, and you can go online and also stream it. So it's available, and it's out there right now. Peter Stormer, thank you for joining us today on Main Street.
Thank you very much, and all my love up there to Minnesota and the Dakotas, and I hope you're safe, sane, and sanitized during this winter, because we've gone through some hard times, but there's light way, way back there in the tunnel. I can see the light.
Okay. Coming up on Main Street, Laurel Reuter, Executive Director of the North Dakota Museum of Art, will talk about the pandemic's effect on her mission. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A legislative committee is considering a bill requiring a governor to call lawmakers into a special session if there is an extended emergency, such as the current COVID-19 pandemic. The bill would allow the legislature to weigh in on executive orders. Lawmakers would be allowed to meet remotely, and lawmakers would have to be convened after the first 30 days of a declared emergency. The bill's main sponsor is Edinburgh Republican State Senator Yana Myrdal. She told the Senate Judiciary Committee the legislative branch should be involved in the discussions going forward.
This is not a simple reaction to the current virus nor the current executive administration. It is not about personalities. It's not about politics, and it's not about power, but rather a direction for the future.
But Governor Burgum's chief of staff, Jace Beeler, says Burgum has been in contact with legislative leaders and local officials as the state deals with the pandemic.
What problem are we attempting to solve? As executive orders were requested from various stakeholders, associations, agencies, and citizens, if they were implemented, they were reviewed and discussed on a weekly and biweekly basis to deem when it was appropriate to implement. Orders were modified in response to changing circumstances or eliminated if no longer necessary.
The Judiciary Committee did not take immediate action. Myrdal offered an amendment that local governments could not impose their own tougher restrictions than what the legislature would approve. That amendment will be considered later. According to the State Health Department COVID vaccine dashboard, 41,288 doses of vaccine have been administered in the state. That's out of 52,525 doses received so far. Most of the vaccine has been deployed in North Dakota's most populous counties. Over 11,000 doses have been administered in Cass County, nearly 5,400 in Burley County, and more than 4,000 in Grand Forks County. More than 32,000 people who have received doses so far have had their first doses, and just under 5,000 residents are covered by both doses. There are currently 388 enrolled provider sites that are approved to administer the vaccine across the state. And the Public Service Commission wants to be able to take a look at the integrated resource plans filed by investor-owned utilities. Those outline what plans they have for their mix of power generation. The utilities submit their plans to the PSC, but the commission has never had the authority to charge the utilities a fee for a more thorough look. Commission Chairman Julie Fedorchuk says in the past, the commission's review is more cursory. She says charging the utility fee will allow the PSC to hire outside consultants. Fedorchuk says she doesn't envision this being done on every resource plan.
But on those that we feel have a pretty significant impact, we want to have the resources to do that and to really weigh in advance when the companies are looking, 5 to 10 years ahead where they're going to be. We can tell them this is what's important to North Dakota. This is how we feel about your plans and really put our signature on that.
Commissioner Brian Krasha says this would be done to benefit the consumer. He says things are changing rapidly in that industry.
Ultimately, what's the value proposition to the end user, particularly low-income households? Can it serve as a tool to keep rates down? That has to be the goal, and not just for low-income, but for all entities, whether it's a household or a business.
A hearing on this measure is scheduled for Thursday afternoon. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Chuck Lura is the naturalist who writes and voices the natural North Dakota essays you hear on Prairie Public. For many years, he taught college biology, and although he's retired from the classroom, he still likes to share his knowledge of the environment where we live. Today, his curiosity focuses on the occasional relief on our state's landscape in an essay titled Mountain Removal Project.
Some of you longtime North Dakota residents may recall the old North Dakota tourism campaign, North Dakota Mountain Removal Project Completed. That campaign back in the day was complete with highway billboards. But any knowledge of the present-day North Dakota geography would indicate that the mountain removal project was not completed. I was thinking about that recently when I noticed the town of Mountain on my North Dakota highway map. Mountain, located in Pembina County, was named for its proximity to the nearby Pembina Mountain. Some references from the 1800s called the Pembina Mountain the Hare Hills. These days, of course, most everyone knows the area as the Pembina Hills. The term mountain gets used and misused a lot, and the name of an area can even change over time. I happen to live in one of those areas. Most people call my home area the Turtle Mountains, but I've seen several historical references to Turtle Mountain, singular, Turtle Hills, and even Beckoning Hills. The highest point in Turtle Mountain is 2,541 feet above sea level at Boundary Butte, which, as the name implies, is on the border with Manitoba. That's 904 feet above Bontenal, which is often listed as 1,637 feet above sea level. North Dakota also has the Kildare Mountains, which are higher. I'm not sure about the peak elevation there, and there are two notable peaks to them, but I've read it's over 3,200 feet. The highest point in the state is 3,507 feet, but that, of course, is White Butte. We also have Devil's Lake Mountain in Ramsey County, Blue Mountain in Nelson County, Lookout Mountain in Eddy County, and Tracy Mountain south of Medora. With all the impressive buttes in the western part of the state, Sentinel, Bullion, and others, I can't help but wonder why Tracy Mountain was so named. Maybe Tracy Mountain just sounded better. Perhaps a new tourism campaign is in order to inform and entice tourists that the mountains are still here. The use of the term mountain may be relative, but they are mountains. I'm Chuck Lehrer.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. Subscribe to the podcast or find past episodes at prairiepublic.org.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and joining me now, Laurel Reuter. She is the founding director and the chief curator of the North Dakota Museum of Art on the campus of the University of North Dakota. Thanks for joining us today, Laurel.
Thank you for inviting me. Isn't that what they say?
Let's get a little background here, because the museum was something that happened because of you and others, I guess. How did the museum come to be?
Well, I was just out of college and was married, and my husband tried out for a football, pro football, and after a while he came home with his shoes and said, "No, I'm too small." And so we decided to come back to Grand Forks to finish degrees at the university, and that meant for me, it was a master's degree in English, and for him, it was work towards a PhD in education. And I needed a job, and he had been a big jock here, and so, you know, they take care of their jocks in these places. And so the head of the student union said, "Hey, we've got this space up on the third floor, and we'd like to like students to be able to show their work there. Would you keep it open?" And I took it as a hourly job as I was in school. And I became interested. And I became interested in what is light, what is space, how do you present art? And I stayed on. We were divorced, and I stayed on. And gradually, it just became an important venue for art. And I was halfway into it before I realized I was turning it into a full-time job, or it was being turned into a full-time job. And it just grew out of that, the Student Union Art Galleries. And then we got the name designation as the State Art Museum. And we had to change our name. And a woman who had given us some money to make a gallery wanted it named after her. Her name was Laura. She researched the name and wanted it to be the Laurel Art Gallery. And I said, when I heard that, "Oh, God, no, I'm not going to do that." So we immediately had it named the North Dakota Museum of Art. Officially.
And how did that come to be? Because there would be other galleries in the state, weren't there? I mean, how did it come to be that That one on the campus of UND became the North Dakota Museum of Art.
Because I said it was. And I appointed myself director, and nobody cared. And that's how it happened, and it grew. And there certainly were supporters. And the director of the student union, Ken Brandt, was a good supporter in the beginning years. And gradually the funding got tossed around, and it became, I came under the president of the university, but stayed within the student union for many years.
What is the mission that guides your museum?
Well, the obvious mission is to show, develop the history of art in North Dakota, to show it and to collect it for the state, to give art a living presence across the state of North Dakota. At that point, we had small galleries within the various university or colleges, and we all got together and made an organization called the North Dakota Art Gallery Association. And through them, we started sharing exhibitions. It happened because we had a lot of people knowing it was time. And we had me who said, of course we can do this. Although everybody said, no, you can't do that. That won't happen. We tried. So my perpetual optimism and the friends that we all became friends that joined us.
And what year would that have been approximately?
Do you know what? It's either 72 or 74. And it just so gradually happened that we never put a date on it till afterwards. So I think we say 72.
You're coming up on your 50th anniversary in not too many years here. Let's look back at the year that we're glad to say goodbye to, 2020. How has the pandemic affected your operations, your bottom line, and for that matter, perhaps your future?
Well, it totally wiped out a huge bunch of our income because we have some small endowments, not much, and we have regular funding that would come from the state of North Dakota. I think it's about 130 it started out for the rural arts program. But mostly our money came from events that we sponsored. The museum, the annual dinner in the winter, there's a whole bunch of them. Summer concert series, winter concert series. The things that we could charge money for. The museum is free. We don't have an entrance fee. And we've lost all of that income.
So what does that portend for 2021, or for that matter, your 50th anniversary in 2022?
Oh, I think that we will go out there and friends will join us, and we'll find the money. It just has to come from different sources. And we've been fortunate. There have been some nice checks that have come in this past week. $25,000 came. A friend of the museum and a trustee, Lois Wild, died a year ago. And she left $300,000. And we've been gradually living off of that. It means we'll just have to work harder in a different way. And we have to get more people on board helping us.
How vulnerable is the museum at this point, then? I mean, you've got to raise money. You've mentioned that. You've had some donations come in that have proved to be timely. But, money is money. It burns up eventually, and you need more. Is the museum in any peril?
I personally don't think so, but I also know no one is going to work as hard as I have. That a new director, and we're preparing for a new director, I've been here an awful long time, a new director is going to have to find their own path. Right now we've got about, 100, maybe 100,000, maybe between 80 and 100,000 available cash. And we're closed except a few hours a week. But it's still, I'm trying to maintain the staff, the core professional staff, and hold the museum together as an institution. And I think we can do that. I have to think we can do it.
Have you ever had the collection appraised? Do you have a sense of how valuable the collection is that you hold?
Oh, my goodness. We know what it was worth when we took it in, and that's about $4.5 million. This year, we will take in $300,000 and $400,000. I'm just trying to add it up in my head. It's maybe $500,000 worth. The collection is growing wonderfully, and that's exciting.
Well, one of the costs of overhead is maintaining the environment that works of art might require in terms of humidity, those kinds of things. How would you say the facility handles that particular requirement?
We have to be careful when we book certain exhibitions. I wouldn't book a textile exhibition in the summer. I would shoot for the dead of winter when the days are shorter and the sun is lower. We have to be very careful. I remember one time we brought in a big exhibition about maps, and it was extremely valuable. And it cost us $80,000 to build boxes within the galleries so that we had the climate control. It's an issue, and we're always careful of it. And that was why the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis did their big expansion. They had a building, they had as much problem with humidity as we do. You've got a shell in a very cold climate, and when it was built, it wasn't built with that in mind, or it's old renovated space. So it's an issue. Our plan, if things were to go forward as they were planned, was that under the last president of the university, we were negotiating taking over or at least using part of the gymnasium, the armory, which is to the east of the museum. And we would use the upper story for collection storage. And we would put in a couple galleries to use for permanent collection display. But I don't know what's going to happen now.
You were born and raised on the Spirit Lake Dakota Reservation. I discovered that as I was doing a little research for our chat today. And that brings to mind the significance of Native American arts. And how is that reflected in the North Dakota Museum of Art? And is that aspirational in the terms of what you want to take it to?
We have fewer objects in that part of our collection. We have done lots of exhibitions, and mostly I've concentrated on commissioning Native artists to make work based in their own lives on the reservation or wherever they're living. Right now, we've got a commission going of commissioning traditional artists to make new but traditional art. And I think that, you know, there are collections, the State Heritage Center has a lot of them, of their work. The Plains in Fargo has it, Minot has it. It's less important that we collect, especially historical stuff, and more important that we collect art that's been made in the last 30 years. So that's where we are. But we do a lot of it, but more in collections and commissioning, not collections.
About a month ago, I spoke with Christy Wolfhart, the executive director of the Public Arts Commission in Grand Forks, about the city's expansion and support of public art. Let's talk about the arts community in general in your town, Grand Forks. How would you assess the resilience or perhaps the lack of resilience among the nonprofit arts organizations as they've had to deal with this pandemic?
I think Grand Forks is very lucky, and most people don't know this, but we probably have had the most active arts community in the state. And I think that in the early days spun over to other communities following our lead. And that's not something that many people will agree with. Not many people have been around as long as I have watching it. And so I think that bears us well. How are the arts groups doing today? I don't know yet. I know that there, once the weather warms up, there will be more activities outside, the out-of-doors. I don't know that I can answer that question very well. We're also isolated.
Your own organization, of course, probably takes precedence. That's your future and all of that. But you're also a writer. How would you describe your creative status? Are you working on anything now?
Oh, I'm always working on stuff. And I've always got stuff that's due.
For instance?
A couple of catalogs of exhibitions we've had. It's usually writing about art. And periodically somebody wants an essay for something, and I just, if I can help them, I will, but I turn down more than I ever accept these days. We don't have a lot of writers about art in our state, and it's hard work, but it's really good for me to do it.
Well, the pandemic disrupted whatever scheduling you had in 2020, and typically art museums are working well ahead to secure the rights or get some traveling exhibition in or do whatever needs to be done. So how far into the future are you planning now, given the relative uncertainty in the near future, until we're all vaccinated, I guess?
Starting today was the first of the year. My goal is to put together a schedule, but pulling it up from what we were all already committed for. And I'm going back, talking to the artists or whomever, and we're just trying to, I think it'll go forward, and I think we've got enough shows in the hopper that we've promised that we have to do that'll certainly carry us another maybe 2 years of promised stuff.
Here's hoping that those 2 years are less fraught with circumstance than 2020 was. Laurel, thank you for spending some time with us today.
Yeah, I hope I answered more questions than I posed.
You did, indeed. Laurel Reuter is the founding director and the chief curator of the North Dakota Museum of Art at the University of North Dakota. Thanks for spending time with us.
Thank you.
More Main Street in a moment.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
We all like to think we're experts on ourselves. But what if that's not even remotely true?
We think that we can look inwards and find out everything. So we forget, for example, that a lot of prejudice and stereotyping happens unconsciously.
The Introspection Illusion, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public. This is Dakota Datebook for January 11th. On this date in 1912, readers of the Washburn Leader learned that women were no longer content to take a back seat when it came to farming.
The article stated the outdoor life was luring women to the Great Plains. Within the previous 2 years, many women had chosen farming over teaching, clerking in stores, or doing secretarial work. While noting that modern machinery made farming easier, the women agreed that the main attraction was an active life in the open air. Throughout the Great Plains, women farmers were viewed as something of a curiosity. In 1911, female farmers met in Fargo for an organizational meeting. The members had to be women who were active farmers, and according to the Fargo Forum and Daily Republican, not one man was allowed to speak. A similar organization met for the first time in Missouri at about the same time. In 1916, the Iowa Women's Farmers Conference met to present informative sessions. A survey at that time estimated that there were over 5,000 women farmers in Iowa alone. In 1918, the nonpartisan Leader newspaper called attention to women farmers who organized to support each other. The article focused on egg circles for women involved in egg and poultry production. These organizations offered education and support to women producers. The 1910 census reported that there were over 300,000 women throughout the United States who listed farming as their occupation. Some states took steps to actively include women and girls in agricultural classes. Missouri recruited women for the agricultural program at the University of Missouri. Rural counties in Missouri included girls in elementary school agriculture classes. Yet women farmers were still considered an oddity. Newspapers felt compelled to make mention of the fact that while some of the women were young, those who were not married had no interest in changing their single status unless it includes the outdoor life. Women are still making a success of farming in North Dakota. According to the United States Department of Agriculture, 26% of North Dakota farmers are women. They farm over 12 million acres. The economic impact of women farmers in the state is $136.5 million. As one woman farmer says, we have to prove ourselves every day, not only to the community, but to ourselves. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org, and after the stream or broadcast, you can find any Main Street show right there at prairiepublic.org. Tuesday on our show, Amy Martin is very well known to public radio listeners for her reports on All Things Considered and the world. She's also the founder and executive producer for Threshold, and on our show tomorrow, we'll talk about drilling for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And North Dakota Tourism Director Sarah Audie Coleman will talk to us about tourism during and after the pandemic. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.